call the House and Senate Labor and Commerce Committees to order. It's approximately 5 minutes after eight. We're in room 120 of the Capitol Building, Tuesday, March 24th. House members present are Representative Book, Representative Coghill, and the esteemed chair of the committee, Representative Olson, and then...
Did I get a promotion?
And then Representative Holmes, and to my right also is Senator Myers. I am Senator Joe Pascavan. And today we are here for the Regulatory Commission's presentation, and if you would please be so kind as to step forward and identify yourself and get the show on the road.
My name is Bob Pickett. I am chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I would like to thank Chairman Pascavan and Chairman Olson and members of the House and Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for the opportunity to be here this morning. I know time is precious this late in the session, and 8 o'clock in the morning, I made some sacrifices, and thanks for the donuts to make it a little easier on all of us. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska was created by the Alaska Legislature in 1999, replacing the old Alaska Public Utilities Commission. It consists of five commissioners appointed by the governor for a six-year term and confirmed by the legislature. I've been a commissioner for a year now and was elected chair of the commission in July. The chairman has the responsibility for the administrative functions of the agency to make sure the workflow continues, and is also the spokesperson for the commission, and that's why I'm here this morning. I prepared a brief overview of the Regulatory Commission, what our statutory authority is, and towards the end of the presentation, just outlining a couple of critical areas that were involved with and I think merit some attention. It's not meant to be a comprehensive review of everything we're involved with, because you can see as I'll go through the presentation there's a wide range of activities the Commission is responsible for. Our authority does come from 4205-141A, in which we at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska do things necessary and proper to regulate every public utility engaged or proposing to become engaged in the utility business inside the state of Alaska. And I'll spend a couple of minutes on some definitional issues. You'll see that it does impact some critical energy types of concerns that we have and how the RCA will be involved with that. The definition of a public utility, it includes every corporation, whether it's public, cooperative, or otherwise, individual or association of individuals, their lessees, trustees, or receivers appointed by a court that owns, manages, or controls any plant, pipeline, or system for A, furnishing by generation, transmission, or distribution, electrical service to the public for compensation. There is a B that deals with telecom, for those dots there. I'm not going to spend much time delving into that today, but I will be open to questions from members of the committees. Furnishing water, steam, or sewer service to the public for compensation. Furnishing by transmission or distribution of natural or manufactured gas to the public for compensation. And furnishing for distribution or by distribution petroleum or petroleum products to the public for compensation when the consumer has no alternative in the choice of a comparable product at an equal or lesser price. Definition of the general public from 4205-993. It's a group of 10 or more customers that purchase the service or a commodity furnished by a public utility, and one or more customers that purchase electrical service for use within an area that's certificated to and presently or formerly served by an electric utility, if the total compensation the electric utility receives for sales of electricity exceeds $50,000. And this impacts some of these alternative energy projects that are out there. And I think you, as members of the committee, need to be aware of that. C, continuing the definitional section, a utility purchasing the product or service or paying for the transmission of electrical energy, natural or manufactured gas, or petroleum products that are resold to a person or group that's included in A or B of this section and used to produce the service or commodity sold to the public by the utility. It starts with the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, or the CPCN. Currently, the Commission, including some of the small provisional certifications for small water and sewer utilities in rural Alaska, we currently have approximately 650 CPCNs across the state. And we cannot issue a certificate unless we find that the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide the utility services applied for, and that the services are required for the convenience and necessity of the public. There are some exemptions, and I'll take the electric area because that is a hot topic these days. Exemptions from certification is any utility making less than $50,000 unless their customers petition for regulation, and the citations are in the parentheses. Any joint action agency established by AS 42-45-310, and possibly utilities that receive a qualifying facility or QF designation from the Federal Energy Regulatory or the FERC. Those are the exemptions from certification. There's another level of exemptions, and that's from economic regulation. Utilities are owned by a political subdivision, with the exception of a utility that competes with a regulated utility.
If we could just interrupt for one moment. First, I'd like to announce that Senator Thomas has joined us, and then Representative Book.
Mr. Chairman, are you going to entertain questions at the end, or what's your pleasure as far as the...
Feel free to interrupt me at any point.
I think it's appropriate that if you have a question, that we... Yes, ask the question.
Mr. Chairman, qualifying facility, could you give us a definition of qualifying facility here?
Qualifying facility is a category of electrical producers that the federal government has deemed important for purposes of distributed generation, encouraging the development of alternative energy. And essentially what a QF does, or a qualifying facility, is if an entity that is proposing to produce power self-certifies, there's a process that they can actually self-certify to the FERC, or goes through the formal FERC certification process, and they are trying to sell their power to an electrical utility and perhaps meeting some reticence on the part of the utility. It's a little bit of a, for lack of a better term, it's sort of a hammer. They can essentially, if they meet all the qualifications, force the utility into purchasing the power and negotiating with them.
Follow up, if you might, please. So this is a generator. This is not a distributor.
No, this is not a distributor.
Okay, thank you.
And this is a federal designation.
Thank you.
And when they receive the federal designation, we have to respect that and abide by the terms of it. I'll continue if there's no further questions in the section exemptions from economic regulation. Another exemption is utilities that make between $50,000 and $500,000 and they have a deregulation election will be exempt from economic regulation, and cooperatives that have a deregulation election. And again, utilities that receive the qualifying facility designation from the FERC. Just a broad overview of what the RCA does regulate. Under utilities, natural gas distribution, natural gas pipelines within the state, electrical power generation, transmission and distribution, water and sewer, telephone, solid waste. And on the pipeline side, which is under 4206, crude oil pipelines within the state, petroleum product pipelines, and natural gas pipelines.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm mistaken, but it seemed to me that for some period of time, until maybe recently, that, good morning anyhow, Fairbanks Natural Gas was not economically regulated, or am I mistaken in that? That was due to something?
They continue to not be economically regulated. There was a petition. A number of legislators signed a letter and addressed it to the commission to open a docket and reevaluate that whole situation. At this point, because of the fact it is an open docket, I can't say a lot other than the fact that the Attorney General has arrived at a stipulation with Fairbanks Natural Gas, and the commission will be acting on that shortly.
Not to pry into it anymore, but could you just mention the particular reasoning why it was not initially economically regulated?
That's my question. My understanding, and I was not at the commission when that decision was made, was it was believed that the size of the utility was such that it would be too much of a burden. I mean, when you have a utility that is economically regulated, there are costs associated with that. Rate cases can be timely and very time-consuming and money-consuming, too, for the utility. I think when that designation of not having them regulated was given, it was with the understanding that that would be reevaluated on an ongoing basis as the utility grows.
I believe that's correct. And there was also the aspect of it competing as well with fuel oil.
Fuel oil, right, and alternatives there, right. Okay,
great. Just wanted to make sure I was correct. Thank you.
Yes. I'm going to talk a few minutes just about our role in a couple of current energy supply issues and focus on three in particular: the Cook Inlet natural gas supply issue, the electric utility current infrastructure needs, and the power cost equalization program. And some of these can be quite contentious and quite controversial, but feel free to ask questions and I'll answer to the best of my ability. I'd like to talk a little bit about the RCA role in the whole Cook Inlet gas for the utility situation. The first point is the RCA does not regulate the producers of natural gas in Cook Inlet. But the RCA does evaluate gas sale agreements, or GSAs, between the utilities and the producers. And our standard of review considers whether the utility acted in a prudent manner, whether the terms of the GSA are reasonable, and whether the GSA ensures reliable and reasonably priced utility service.
Commissioner, if you say you do not regulate the producers, but on the page before you say you regulate the supplies, could you explain what might be a possible?
I'm talking on the page before. I was just outlining the overall Cook Inlet natural gas supply issue, because I think it's important when you analyze the Cook Inlet gas market, it operates as a system, and the utilities are but one part of that system. And the RCA has nothing to do with the LNG plant or, you know, certain large commercial and industrial customers.
So the quantities of, or the discoveries of a producer, though that is not information that is regulated by you or made available to
we
you?
We do not regulate the operation of the gas fields in Cook Inlet. But to the information that is available through the public, is publicly available, not all information is. I mean, because the companies have legitimate commercial needs to, you know, hold certain information quite close. But to the extent, and we work with DNR in trying to assess what the situation is out there and what is known. But there's a lot of things that are not known.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I believe the first natural gas pipeline that you did regulate was the KPLL, which mm-hmm. is the Kenai Peninsula liquid line. Is that line considered as a component of the Cook Inlet natural gas configuration?
Well, I think, yeah, most definitely. The regulated pipelines are going to be part of the system in the inlet.
Are there any of them, are there other pipelines that are now under your purview, such as the one that comes from Beluga as well?
The Beluga, we have a tariff before the commission at this point with the Beluga Pipeline Company that is not resolved, but yes, that is under the jurisdiction of the commission.
What other pipelines do you have purview over that pertain particularly to the Cook Inlet natural gas?
SIGS would be the gathering system, you know, on the inlet.
Okay. That's it?
Then there's the South Kenai Peninsula pipeline and the NSTAR pipeline system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay, let me get back to where I... Now I'm going to talk about the standard of review and where the statutory authority is for that. We're guided by 4205-431A, and under this subsection, we're required to determine whether a gas sale agreement or particular terms within such an agreement are unjust, unreasonable, unduly discriminatory, or preferential. And this determination needs to be viewed in the context of the Cook Inlet market, which is very unique among natural gas markets in the United States. The natural gas markets in the lower 48 are connected and interconnected by a very sophisticated and extensive series of pipelines that, you know, if one particular field is not producing the way folks think it should or could be, there's alternatives. We don't have that in the inlet nearly to the extent that's available outside. The reserves to production ratio for Cook Inlet's approximately 10 to 1. This is in the same range as typical in the lower 48. It's lower than what we have been used to in past years just because we had such an abundance of natural gas in the inlet that by and large was found as a byproduct of looking for oil. Cook Inlet's also unique as the home of the only plant in the United States that liquefies natural gas and ships it out of the immediate area as LNG. And this is the oldest LNG export facility in the world, too. The RCA and our EO 858, which is the last natural gas sales agreement review that we had, did find that the Cook Inlet's a natural gas production basin as opposed to a city gate or consuming type of area. And ConocoPhillips, Marathon, and Union Oil, a division of Chevron Union, control the vast majority of the natural gas supplies in the inlet. They're the ones that have been, over the years, the most active in bringing gas to the market. And of the three, ConocoPhillips and Marathon are the two largest. And ConocoPhillips and Marathon own the Kenai LNG export facility. The Cook Inlet market is vertically integrated, with the two largest producers being their best customers through the sales to the LNG export facility.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Booth.
Maybe this is would be a time for some clarification on an overview, if we could.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious how we all came to this possibility here. In the 20s, this particular issue was resolved in a Supreme Court case against Standard Oil, and vertical integration was considered a monopoly. So we're right back to that same realm of operation where producers actually have access, they have the leasing, they have the production, they have the manufacturing, they have the consumer sale directly. And it is once again a legal operation?
I think it's important to make the distinction when the commission in EO 858 found there was market power. That is not the same as a monopolistic finding, okay? And we worked closely with the Attorney General's office on a number of these issues, and there's no evidence that there's anything illegal going on in Cook Inlet. Market power, it can be legal. It can be a business strategy, too. But I think the point the commission is making is when those conditions do exist and an individual utility is attempting to procure natural gas supplies, there's a little bit of a mismatch at the negotiating table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Commissioner, please continue.
The Cook Inlet market is not open, and it's not an open and transparent gas market. You cannot pull up Platts like you can for the lower 48 and go to each of the production basins and get a price both for today and, you know, into the future as far as what futures are trading for and say this is what the price of natural gas is. There's few transactions and they tend to be somewhat intermittent. You know, you don't negotiate natural gas contracts every day. and some of them are just not available in a public form. The information is just not available. There is no commonly accepted natural gas pricing mechanism in Cook Inlet, and that makes it a challenge because since the 2001 RCA Henry Hub order, a variety of pricing proxies have been considered by the utilities, the producers, the Attorney General, and the RCA. But none of those proxies have been accepted by all of the parties that need to have that understanding. And none of these pricing proxies has resulted in an RCA-approved gas sale agreement that currently delivers gas to utility customers. And given the fact that several of the utilities are headed for a cliff in terms of their gas supply agreements in the next couple of years and out, this is a matter of most serious public concern, in my opinion.
Senator.
He's just giving us all promotions today. I like
the tongue, didn't it?
I'm used to that.
I'll tell Senator Terrio enjoyed that thought.
So what has been the discussion between the export and the utility need with regard to your regulation?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, what has been the discussion as far as the DOE, the Department of Energy export license?
Well, I know we got an export license,
right.
But as far as you regulating the utility, knowing full well that there is a gas capacity that is going out in LNG on export, you're asked on one hand to regulate the utility, and yet you have this gas supply that diminishes, knowing that you have a cliff coming. And we have an LNG export that is a continual drain on that. Has there been anything that within your purview that caused you to deal with that as a pricing issue or a systemic issue?
We're certainly very cognizant of it. In fact, in EO 858, we subsumed the entire DOE record into that record because of the information that was present in that. And within that order, that final order we had, the commission recognized the importance of the LNG export facility because the utility ratepayers and the amount of gas consumed there alone is not a sufficiently large amount of consumption to create the incentives needed for the exploration and production that's going to have to take place in the inlet. I'll be the first to admit, it's a very, very tricky situation. The LNG plant is operating under a two-year export license that actually begins in about a week. Okay. Within the settlement agreement with the state in January of 2008, there were terms in that indicated, as we're sitting here today, there are conversations between the producers and DOE and the state for a five-year export license if they can demonstrate the sufficient quantities and make that kind of a finding. Deliverability is a key issue in the inlet right now. NSTAR came before the commission with other utilities at a special public meeting on Saturday early in January at the time we were having the cold snap, because 2 years prior to that, they felt they were close to hitting the deliverability wall. These fields aren't like a big balloon with a valve on it, and you just sort of go out and crank the valve on high and there's going to be sufficient gas. It's a much more complicated and delicate balancing act than that, and storage is a big part of that.
Yeah. Representative Coghill.
And actually, that was going to be my next question. Then, is that something that you as a regulator are going to require for customer protection, or is that something that we as a legislature need to look at? Not that I necessarily want to protect the South Central entirely, but I just had to say that for my buddies.
Where are your?
Is that something that we need to look into as far as a statutory setup, or is that something that you and the regulatory scheme?
Again, We do not regulate the producers, and each and every one of the producers has its own business model and set of calculations that they're going to do to determine what level of investment they're going to make or not make in these fields. And many of these are international companies, and it's a very challenging environment out there right now with the collapse of the commodity prices and the implosion of the financial markets. It makes those calculations all the more difficult. And so I think if I had to say one thing, there needs to be some sort of agreement on how you price gas in Cook Inlet that is fair to the ratepayers and is, you know, defensible based on some kind of a record, whether that be with the RCA or through legislative hearings or whatever that, and at the same time creates sufficient incentives for the producers to continue to do business in Cook Inlet.
One last, and then I'll leave it. But isn't that part of what the convenience and necessity drives in your world? That the capacity to fill the need and convenience of the customer base that has already been set. Does that trump the company's interest in selling on the market LNG? Because you're involved in the power, I mean, the sales agreements as well.
The utility sales agreements for gas. And so your question through the chair, Representative Coghill, is does the power that the RCA has through the certification process, does that trump?
Maybe trump isn't the right word. Does it put pressure on the sales agreements that go into LNG, and would it put pressure on the state to continually agree to a export?
I'm sure it is a factor that would be considered, and I'm sure that the producers understand too that it's in their interest to have utility gas sale agreements in place, because that makes a stronger case for the five-year extension. And you don't want the utilities going before, as they are right now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals attempting to overturn.
Right. Just a comment, Mr. Chairman, and then I'll leave it.
Yeah.
When we liquefy gas, that's a lot of storage that's floating, and it can expand. So that could, in fact, be the balloon that has collapsed for spike times of the winter season in Anchorage. And the question that I would have in my mind is, should we be selling our gas when we so desperately need it?
Would I be correct in assuming that part of the problem is we only have peak demand by the utilities for about 10 weeks during the winter, and the sales to the Tokyo Electric utility is constant in a certain volume every 2 weeks? We've got the same volume going back and sold on a multi-year contract basis, but NSTAR or whoever only needs it for 8 to 10 weeks out of the middle of winter to top off their other contracts, that they couldn't pick up that volume of gas for any more than a 10-week period.
Now, through the chair, Representative Olson, I do believe there is truth to that. In fact, if you look at the deliverability crunch periods in January of this year and in 2 years before that, that diversion of gas flows from the LNG plant into the utility system essentially is what provided the cushion. But the concern now is looking at the figures that NSTAR has produced. The 2009 situation took away a lot of the margin that was still there, and there really isn't much margin left. And that's why gas storage is a critical issue in the inlet. Several of the producers have their own storage, essentially old fields that they're, pumping gas back into. And I know DNR is looking on the west side, the Beluga side, to having RFPs and offering some potential sites for storage there. at our public meeting this Wednesday, we're doing some scoping and consideration of opening two rulemaking dockets, one on trying to arrive at a safe harbor for the pricing of utility gas in the inlet. The R dockets can take time. I mean, that's a process that's not snap your fingers and overnight. It can be a couple-year process. And then we're also looking at natural gas storage for utilities and sort of what the role of the RCA might be in that and how you evaluate the pricing so we don't find ourselves in the same situation we're in today.
Representative Boop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You touched on my question that, you know, what do you see your role in resolution of this dilemma and, you know, how can the legislature move in conjunction with a quasi-political entity that the RCA is. So most of us from the Anchorage area are very concerned that, you know, we're looking at this issue in a way that gives us resolution not for today, but, you know, for after 2011 when we have to relook at that LNG export license. And, you know, that's the time period that some of us are really concerned about. So we do have some time. But, you know, we're very curious as to how the RCA is going to interplay with this decision-making role that, you know, we're right in the process of a real dilemma with. And appreciate your, you know, working through this really tough issue. But some of us are very, very concerned that this has a lot more ramifications than just the Cook Inlet. So, you know, if you could, when at the earliest convenience, give us an outline for your plan for this resolution, it would really help some of us.
Now, through the chair, Representative Book, we certainly will keep you and the legislature apprised as to how it's proceeding with the both of these dockets, with the storage and the natural gas pricing.
How do you intend to keep us apprised?
We can put you on our distribution list. Hopefully we can narrow it down because you don't want to get on the full-blown RCA distribution list. It'll melt your email down.
Right. If you could just give us, you know, part of the process that you're going through as you're going through it so that we could keep apprised of that so that we don't hear it in the newspaper after the fact.
Certainly will.
Commissioner, a comment that you had made is that the utilities were facing a cliff in the next couple of years and years out. And I understand that to mean that their supplies are, there is a perceived scarcity within a few years. Is that an accurate assumption?
I think it's very important to not be overly alarmist. The media does a fairly good job of, you know, framing the issue in a way that keeps people's attention on it. There is gas still in Cook Inlet, okay? It's a matter of price and, you know, what is it going to take to continue to push the there's a chart that DNR has shown to a variety of entities, including the RCA, and it's the waterfall chart, and it's been picked up by some of the utilities, and it kind of shows the production in the inlet and this rather precipitous drop-off in future years. But as exploration and bringing, you know, some of the fields into production continues, that date gets pushed out. But if you don't have the activity and the investment, or if the producers are just concentrating on essentially harvesting known fields and not really bringing new probable reserves into the equation, then that drop-off is much sooner.
The focus of my question to you is somewhat connected with Representative Boog's vertical integration issue. And if there's a perception that there's a cliff in the sense of supplies, but you don't regulate the producers themselves, so you don't know really what the supply is. You're trying to regulate pricing based upon a perception that can be whatever someone wants it to be in a vertically integrated market. Is that fair?
Chair Pascavan, I think there is an element of truth to that, and the information is highly imperfect that we have. We have access to a lot of public records, and I think there is a somewhat of a consensus to some of the broad outlines of what the reality of gas is in Cook Inlet, but there's a lot of details that are, in fact, missing.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all of those thoughts in mind, the Cook Inlet gas, is it worth more to the producers for in-state use or for export? I'm not sure I have the numbers. I realize it's a long-term contract with Japan, but you know, just in general, not only that contract, but if it were more available for export.
So your question through the chair, Senator Thomas, is the gas in Cook Inlet worth more to the producers if they export it? Is that essentially
correct?
Markets are moving targets, and that statement may be true at a particular point in time, but not knowing the details or the length of the contracts, it would just be speculation on my part. All I know is at the time we were having the UO 858 hearings, the NSTAR natural gas hearings, natural gas prices were rocketing up from $6 MCF up to approaching 14. They've now collapsed and they're down in the 360 range. At the time that was all happening, the East Asian LNG market was the hottest LNG market in the world. There was a shortage of tankers. Everybody was scrambling to try to get in on it because they were paying as much as 20 per MCF for short-term contracts at that time. That's totally changed. Japan has released a number of tankers from service in just the last 60 days, as has Korea and Taiwan and Spain. And so there's a lot of excess capacity in the LNG market right now. And so, you know, depending on what point in time you look at, you know, your statement might be true and it might not. I don't mean to be evasive, but that's...
That always seems to be the case with oil and gas. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
Okay. I'm going to talk about another subject area for a few moments, and this is the electric utility infrastructure needs, primarily focusing upon the rail belt area, but there are, you know, needs in rural Alaska too, and with some of the smaller electric utilities out there. You've seen the legislation introduced by the administration, and that was built upon the Alaska Rail Belt Energy Grid Authority study that was issued in September 2008. And in that study, it was estimated that cumulative capital investment needs for the next 30 years would range between $2.5 to $8.1 billion for new generation and transmission capacity primarily. The infrastructure for the major rail belt utilities for generation and transmission is aging, and I'll show a chart that, you know, clearly illustrates how concentrated it is in the rail belt in just a couple of facilities, really. And if you look at the current installed rail belt generation, and you look at the Beluga power plant on the left there, and you look at the two municipal light and power plants towards the bottom of that, that is a significant chunk of all of the generation that is primarily in the southern part of the rail belt, and then going to Fairbanks with Golden Valley's facilities. Some of theirs are a little bit newer, but the southern rail belt facilities, the utilities are at a point where they are going to be doing something with those. These old natural gas turbines are very inefficient. Modern natural gas generation, if that's the fuel source that is chosen to remain with, are 30% more efficient just by putting new technology. And so that would be a savings of gas there. And looking at that little square box on the bottom part of the slide there, you can see the dominance of natural gas for generation purposes in the rail belt, and that ties back to the issue with the natural gas supplies in Cook Inlet. This is just to put into perspective some of the current and the proposed projects that are out there. As you can see, of all of the proposed projects, the Susitna Hydro would dwarf anything else coming on. Chaka-Chamna is a significant proposal, also with 300 megawatts, and the Fire Island wind project has been changed a little bit. Those numbers in the 30 megawatts are dated. I think they're going to, you know, eke a little bit more power out of that with the new configuration.
Representative.
Yes, excuse me.
Yeah, the new configuration is 100, so it's mm-hmm. over three times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As new generation comes on, particularly with the alternative energy and more distributed forms of generation, there are some regulatory issues that need to be addressed and thought about. And I'll start with the firm versus non-firm power supplies. By definition, firm power is a predictable source of power that can be scheduled by a utility and that offsets both fuel and generation capacity expenses. And in this category, you see some hydro, cogeneration, geothermal. It's essentially, you've got a switch, you can flip it, the power's going to be there. Non-firm is a more unpredictable source of power that you really can't schedule it by a utility. And the provision of non-firm power only offsets the use of fuel by the utility. And the generation capacity needs to be maintained to provide power when that non-firm power is unavailable. In fact, in the Commission's regulations and how we, you know, conduct our oversight of utilities, we require spare capacity, and that's got to be available at all times.
Chairman? Yes, just the requirement on that spare capacity, 10%, 12%, 18%?
The exact, I'll be careful about how I word this, but it has to do with the largest generation unit that you have if it were to go offline. It's like Beluga is actually a series of generators. It's not just one big generator over there. And so the theory being if that generation unit does go offline, you have the ability to make it up. And I am going to talk just a few minutes about the Power Cost Equalization Program, or the PCE. And as you're well aware, under the PCE program, the state of Alaska pays a portion of electric bills for consumers that are served by utilities that participate in the program. The RCA, we established the PCE rate, cents per kilowatt hour, that's applicable to each utility participant's billings, regardless of whether the utility is otherwise subject to our economic regulation. Which I'll use this as an opportunity to make the statement the RCA has a number of unfunded mandates given to us by the state of Alaska and the federal government. We are supported by RCCs, or regulatory cost charges, that are on each consumer ratepayer in an economically regulated utilities jurisdiction. On the bill is a figure of their contribution to the RCA. It's 0.7%. And different industry groups have a different calculation as far as how much of that's applicable. But the PCE program, most of the smaller utilities are not regulated. And so in essence, what's happening is the ratepayers in regulated utilities are paying for the PCE program. Now, OMB, we've made OMB aware of this, and the administration, I believe we're going to get a little bit of relief through some cooperative agreement with the AEA on this, so hopefully that'll be addressed. There are more than 150 communities that do participate in the PCE program.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a ballpark figure of what that might, look like as far as what a rebate to the RCA for those several utilities would look like.
I believe the figure is going to, we're looking to pick up a couple of staff equivalents, you know, basically the cost of what it takes our people to, you know, do the filings and do a lot of the work with some of the small struggling utilities that are out there having great difficulty just getting their paperwork together to be eligible for the program.
So it's a staffing problem primarily?
Yes, it's a staffing problem primarily.
That's what I want. Thank you.
And AS 4245110C2 provides that the commission during each fiscal year adjusts the power cost for which PCE may be paid to an electric utility based on a weighted average retail residential rate in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, subject to the statutory ceiling, whatever that is at that point in time. The actual PCE program itself is administered by the Alaska Energy Authority. They're the ones that cut the checks.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to remember, last year when Juneau's hydro went offline and they went to diesel, we did make an adjustment, didn't we, last year, so that the rate based on Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks didn't go too high? Was that,
yeah,
there was sort of a one-time adjustment?
One-time adjustment.
Okay, thank you. Just making sure that my memory was working.
Okay, the RCA role in renewable and alternative energy. The RCA opened dockets R091 and R092 to consider net metering and interconnection standards. The federal government, through the 2005 Energy Policy Act, mandated that all commissions across the country consider what are called the PURPA standards. It included net metering, interconnection standards, smart grid, things of that nature. And the commission conducted a two-year proceeding on that and elected to not adopt any of the federal standards because we just thought they were not appropriate for Alaska conditions. But we did open dockets on net metering and interconnection standards, and those are currently underway. Our goal in the net metering R091 docket is to create an Alaska rule that will encourage the development of distributed small-scale renewable generation while maintaining system integrity and fairly apportioning costs among consumers and consumer producers. We have had a technical workshop on that in, I believe that was in late February, and had a technical workshop last week on the interconnection standards. The industry is heavily engaged in that with the utilities, proponents of net metering with some of the alternative energy. We probably had more input on the prior docket relating to net metering than we had just about any docket in the last couple years.
We're going to be considering net metering in the range of venues here. So what we should do is, it seemed to me like we would benefit from some of the discussion you had. So in that docket where you rejected the federal standards, is there a packet of rationale and how you arrived at your conclusions? That might help us in our deliberations on how we might proceed with our standards in giving you direction.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Coghill, in our order declining those standards, a rationale is explained, and we could also make available, it's all on our, we've got a very good website too that has all of the information from hearings and technical workshops and all of that, so we could certainly work with your office to, and Representative Olson's office.
We have two bills in the House. I don't know how many you have in the Senate, one of which is mine, and I believe both of the House bills will probably be pulled until after the RCA finishes their work. What kind of time frame do you...
Through the chair, Representative Olson, when we declined to adopt the federal standards, we did commit to as expedited a process as we could because we were able to subsume that record into the new docket and make use of a lot of those comments and hopefully speed it up. The issues are fairly well clarified at this point, I think.
Thank you, Representative Booten.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you make those available to the chairman so that all of the members of this committee could access that?
Now, through the chair, Representative Book, certainly.
Thank you. And just as a comment, there's, I believe, an alternative method other than net metering, as I can't remember the phrase, it's like a tariff system or.
Senator Passman, perhaps you're referring to the SNAP program that Golden Valley has instituted and Homer Electric recently. It's a little bit different than the net.
No, I believe German.
Okay.
This system is like phased-in tariffs where it's a different pricing mechanism than net metering?
Senator Pat, I'm just not familiar with that, and so... continuing, on R092, this is the interconnection standard that, again, recognizes Alaska conditions and provides uniformity in interconnection requirements of Alaska electric utilities and simplifies the interconnection process for small distributed resources. And there's some real technical issues here that have to be dealt with. When you have a very small rural utility, it doesn't take that large of a project to throw the system into imbalance. And even some of the larger utilities on the rail belt have concerns as this progresses and time goes on. You can get to a point where on particular distribution lines, depending on where you're feeding in, they want to make sure they maintain system integrity. Another issue that is out there, the Alaska Energy Authority is requiring that all independent power producers receiving renewable energy grants from the state obtain a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, or CPCN, from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. That there are discussions we've had with the AEA in terms of, in addition to the CPCN, what specifically is it that you're going to be asking the RCA to do? You know, if they're not rate regulated, but you want some additional protections, and we're trying to get that pinned down at this point.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. The standards are going to be one thing, but even given the standards, there is a timeline issue for each one of these. What generally, if you had clear standards, what is a timeline for this certificate?
In all honesty, that is going to depend on how many of these certificate requests we get at the same time. The RCA is severely stressed in terms of staff. That's fairly well known through the RCA task force that the legislature created a couple years ago and reported back. And if it's a handful, they will be handled expeditiously, subject to our workload and the statutory deadlines and all of our other dockets. If we were to receive 30 or 40 of them simultaneously, that would be an entirely different matter, and I would not be able to give you a clear answer on that.
Mr. Chairman, I think the LBNA is going to be watching those very closely, so we need to have a pretty good handle on what's coming and what needs are going to be required of the staff, and since we have the chairman of that particular committee, I thought I'd just raise that flag.
Thank you.
How are the new timelines working out, ones that were implemented 2.5 years ago?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, we are meeting the statutory deadlines. We have had occasion where we've had to extend them, but I would say by and large, they're frustrating for the commission in one sense, but they also have a way of focusing one's attention. That's the first question I ask every day is, what statutory deadline do we have today we have to deal with? But I think the intent of the legislature has been met. The dockets are being, you know, completed and closed out in the time frames we've been given by the legislature.
Representative Book, question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. before you leave today, I would like you to give us an outline for how the price of natural gas is established. You know, how it comes to us here in Alaska.
Okay, you're talking about the current gas supply agreements?
No. I'm talking about the commodity pricing of natural gas. How does that all work so that, you know, for the consumer in the state of Alaska, the bottom line, I want to know how the structure is so that we know we have no control over oil, none. But commodity pricing of natural gas is a structure of the United States. So within those realms, how does that occur?
In Alaska, I think it's fair to say that the pricing of natural gas is determined by the contracts. between the utilities and the producers. Some of these contracts have been going on for many, many years, if not decades. Each of the contracts has a different pricing mechanism embedded within it and tied to, some are tied to the price of crude oil. We have contracts, the 2001 Henry Hub contract with Union and Instar, and so that's tied to a different pricing index. And the latest Instar gas supply agreements that were restructured for 2 years, the commission did not approve them because under the terms of their existing tariff, there is what is called the WACOG option, or the weighted average cost of gas in Cook Inlet, which looks at all of these contracts and comes up with the weighted average depending on the price and the volumes associated with the contract. And as long as they came in under the WACOG, they had the ability to claim those gas charges.
Commissioner, I know one of the topics I was interested in is broadband and how broadband might be brought to Alaska so that we can be competitive in a business environment in, you know, in the days soon upon us. But and there's also federal stimulus monies. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on what percentage of those federal stimulus monies relating to broadband Alaska should be looking to?
We were involved with a broadband grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Rural Utility Services. It's been going on for a number of years. Original dollar figure is about $15 million, and we still have roughly $7.5 million in this because of the conditions that go along with it, and the definitions of broadband were way too low, just totally inadequate for, you know, folks that have dial-up service or very slow broadband. We're not eligible to upgrade their systems. There are some gaps in the system. We've got an area of the state that has some of the most sophisticated telemedicine in the nation. And it's, you know, something the state can truly be proud of. And it's linked to a network that is microwave based, but then it comes to a point where there's a satellite uplink, and that's the bottleneck for the whole system. And then there's a gap on the ground to where you can't interconnect to undersea cable in another part of the state, and that would seem to be a very logical type of project if, you know, stimulus funds were to be available. We provided a lot of comments on the stimulus package and, you know, possibilities and what might be possible. And there's some unresolved issues on the federal side. And quite frankly, some of these funds are going to go directly to the telecommunications companies. They're going to be the ones that will be making application. But rules and regulations have not been established for how you go about prioritizing this. And it probably would be helpful if the state had a comprehensive broadband vision, I guess, for lack of a better term, because, you know, we're in a funny position at the RCA. We regulate some of these entities, and you can't be picking winners and losers and at the same time be regulating. It kind of puts us in a very tenuous position, and I don't think it's appropriate for us to be there. Doesn't mean we can't help with broadband mapping or, you know, some of the setting the stage or, you know, lending what expertise we do have, but it can be a very delicate position.
Well, I know I have another committee meeting at 9, so I, Representative Book, and all due deference.
I would just to follow up on your question. Are there other states that have already set this up? I mean, do we have to reinvent the wheel here? Can we follow a model that's already out there and plug it in? I mean, certainly there's ways of getting around having to, you know, start from scratch here.
Yeah.
A comprehensive broadband vision, as you're talking.
Through the chair, Representative Book, I'm sure there are a number of states, particularly the ones that are more rural, in which we can learn from them. But I can't emphasize enough when it comes to telecommunications, Alaska is in a state of its own, and that's the nature. You look at the small rural telephone companies, you look at, you know, we are told many times by the FCC that, you know, you really have a challenge in Alaska. You know, you kind of get tired of it. hearing that sometimes, but we do. We're sort of at the cutting edge on a number of issues.
I have one final follow-up, if I might.
We got to run.
I know. How many open dockets do you have currently?
Oh, boy. I would say probably, and this is just, this is a swag number. I we have report, but I haven't said an actual count, but probably in the 150 range.
Thank you.
Anyway, Commissioner Pickett, we thank you very much for appearing before the House and Senate Committee, and we appreciate your statements and look forward to receiving the information that we've discussed. And with that, meeting adjourned.